To Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. By my count, we're now on episode number 769. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, as usual now. And I'm delighted to be back for another episode here talking about a fun subject, which I trust will be new to many people. But let me introduce to you first our regular. We have our colleague, Jim Cassidy, who serves as pastor of South Austin OPC down in South Austin, Texas. Hey, Jim, it's good to see you again. Two in a row.
Yeah, 2 days in a row. You'll be sick of me soon enough if you're not already.
Well, I already was, but yeah. To it's nice to have you back. It's good to do these with you. I love talking about these things. And we're going to be speaking today about a really fun subject, but let me introduce first our guest. We have welcoming for the first time to the program, Dr. Arlen Migliazzo. He is a professor emeritus of history at Whitworth University in Spokane, Washington, calling in from Spokane today. How are you doing, Arlen? It's great to see you too.
Doing fine, Camden. Thanks for the invitation.
You bet. You're most welcome. I should mention to our listeners that I got to meet Dr. Migliazzo at the Presbyterian Scholars Conference in Wheaton, Illinois, last year. A very small event, but a wonderful one. If you've listened to this program weekly, you've heard me mention it a bunch of times. But he was on speaking about his book and also interacting with other scholars who were offering responses to this delightful book. The Mother of Modern Evangelicalism, The Life and Legacy of Henrietta Mears. It was published in 2020, published by Erdmans, and we've got a copy here I'm holding on to, and certainly you can buy your own copy. We're going to be speaking about that today. And no doubt, I regret that I did not know much about the subject at all. I'd heard the name Henrietta Mears, but didn't know too much about her, to my shame. And reading the book, well, first off, speaking with you and speaking with others at the conference and then doing some follow-up research, I was certainly intrigued. And I'm really happy to get into this subject today. But before we get into that, I got to ask you a little personal question because I grew up, near Chicago. My big sport growing up is baseball. And my sports idol is Ryan Sandberg from none other than Spokane, Washington. So I don't know. Does he have a memorial there I could visit if I ever come out there?
Well, there's a he went to North Central High School, graduated from North Central High School.
Yeah.
And there's a plaque on the ball field fence that's called Ryan Sandberg Field.
I like it.
So that's it. No plaque yet except for the
just there at the field.
That's his field, yeah.
I keep hoping to run into him one day. He lives in Lake Bluff, which isn't too far from me. But I've run into others, and when I've gone to restaurants there, I'm enough of a fan where I've asked people, "You ever see Rhino in here?" And they're like, "Oh yeah, he was in here like 2 days ago." And rats, I should have been here 2 days ago. But it's one of those things. I also kind of don't want to meet him because then I might be disappointed. So I don't know. Nothing against Rhino. I'm just saying that people say when they meet their heroes, sometimes it's not as good as you would imagine. So I kind of want to just have the idea of him in my mind. That might lead us at least into this subject, because when we're speaking about Henrietta Mears, we're speaking about someone who's done a heck of a lot more significant things, at least for the kingdom of God, than a baseball Hall of Famer, as much as we might like them. But she also is a really enormous figure when we start to think about her accomplishments. And people might be surprised at all the things that she was involved with, the things that she accomplished, the institutions that she founded. And I mentioned before we started recording, we tend to over-index here at Reformed Forum, especially on Presbyterian and OPC history, but also upon the male theologians who are, seminary professors and whatnot, writing books on theology. And we don't spend as much time on the broader evangelical movement or the context in which the OPC is operating, most notably perhaps in the 40s and 50s. So we're going to get into that today, looking more broadly at Henrietta Mears. But before we get into the details, Arlen, I got to ask you this question because I love this in your introduction. How might a bend in the California freeway system tell us about the influence of Henrietta Mears?
Well, I wish I could show you a picture.
Yeah.
US 101, which comes into the LA area as the Hollywood Freeway, comes off a pass from the San Fernando Valley into the LA Basin. And it makes this seemingly pointless arc to the left, right near a street called Gower Street. And then it passes, it's about a quarter of a mile later, it arcs back to the right. And what is in that arc area is the First Presbyterian Church of Hollywood. And when they were building the freeway, you know, they're planning back in the early 50s and built it in the kind of later 50s. A number of people I talked to believe that the reason that that freeway arced like that is because Henrietta Mears was able to influence the planning board. This is the California State Transportation Department, as well as LA County officials, to turn that freeway. Now, I never found any evidence that that was the case. I mean, there was some work on Gower Street, which is where the church is, but I never found any evidence. And it probably wouldn't want to probably record that anywhere in official documents if it was the case.
Right, of course not.
But yeah, that could look a little funny. But it just says something about the influence of this woman, the reputation of this woman in the mid and late 50s in the LA County area particularly.
Yeah, that's notable. Help us, you know, let's at least set the stage on some basic biographical facts before and information before diving down into more interpretive questions about her influence and role and whatnot. But what are her dates, and perhaps what is she most notable for in addition to what you've already mentioned?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was born on October 23rd in 1890, same year Amy Seppel McPherson, who founded the International Church of Pure Gospel, was born. She was born in Fargo, North Dakota. Her mom and dad actually met. Her father's family is all from Vermont, and he moved fairly soon. He was, I think, 20 or 21 when he moved to the Chicago area. He was in the hardware business. Her mom was actually the daughter of a Presbyterian or a Baptist minister in Chicago. He was at First Baptist in Chicago. And that's where it was her grandmother. I'm sorry, not her mother, but her grandmother. Mm-hmm. And they married in 1868, on New Year's Eve in 1868, had seven kids, two of whom died before Henrietta was born in 1890. They moved around a fair bit. They lived in Chicago and then moved to New Jersey, ended up in the Dakota Territory before there were North and South Dakota. And her father became really involved in the real estate business and mortgage industry and that sort of thing in the upper Midwest there. Mm. They moved first in a little town in Ipswich and then to Minot and then finally to Fargo, North Dakota, which is where Henrietta was born. She suffered from some pretty severe medical issues when she was young. There seems to have been an eye weakness in the family. She wasn't the only one that suffered from that. One of her brothers did also, but her eyes are she was pretty myopic. And so she wore glasses from the first day of grade school when she began school. She also they called it muscular rheumatism back then. I think that may be the best way to describe the disease. She had actually killed her best friend when she was a little kid, almost killed her. And she had to be carried around. She couldn't even walk for most of the summer when she was afflicted by it, but recovered from that. Her favorite brother, Will, came down with spinal meningitis and went kind of deaf he couldn't hear very well at all through most of his adult life. And then when she was 16, she drove a hat pin in one of her eyes and severely, of course, injured that. Many people, medical folks, this is again about the 1906 or 7 or so, thought she would be blind before she was 20. And so suffered with that for quite a little while. She also had an experience of healing when she was younger. She had these frequent nosebleeds that just would not stop. I don't know if her blood didn't clot right or something, but she had a Presbyterian minister pray over her, and the bleeding stopped. And so she, for most of her life, really was a believer in faith healing, which again is pretty unique among folks in the Baptist tradition, which is the tradition she was born and raised in. She went to University of Minnesota, graduated with a degree in chemistry, took her teaching credential, taught for 3 years in a couple little towns north of Twin Cities, one near the Wisconsin border and one actually near the Dakota border, two kind of east-west opposite ends of the state. And then she came back to Minneapolis in 1916, which is where she spent much of her formative years, from about 9 through 17 or so. Ended up teaching chemistry at the high school that she actually started high school in, Central High in Minneapolis. And it was then that she became involved in the church of William Bell Riley. Now, she kind of, again, she joined that church when she was 10 years old because her folks moved around a fair bit. And when they finally moved to the Minneapolis area, they went right to Riley's church. And of course, he was one of the founders of the World Christian Fundamentalist Association. And that was his church. And so she kind of grew in maturity in that church. When she came back to Minneapolis in 1916, after being gone for 3 years, she went, got involved in the church again and took over this class of girls. They were adolescent girls, probably high school age.
Yeah.
And they didn't have the best reputation. Her sister actually taught them for a while in Sunday school. And she just, every time Henrietta came to visit from her teaching post when she was on vacation, she always had Henrietta take the class because she just was had it with these young women. They called themselves the Droolers. Now, I don't know where that name came from, but I mean, that gives you some idea what they thought about themselves.
Yeah.
In any event, she taught this, started teaching this class, and actually decreased in number out over the first month or so because the Sunday school superintendent decided to completely revamp the Sunday school, the First Baptist Church of Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. She ended up having like two or three girls. It's kind of unclear. She went out then and canvassed the entire neighborhood, went calling, if you will. We used to call it that in the old days.
Yeah.
On any home that had a young woman between the ages of about 18 to 25. And the first Sunday after they did that, they had 44 young women. And it grew from there. By the later 1920s, the class had grown to an enrollment of over 500. And so she, all the while she's teaching, you know, teaching at the high school at chemistry, and yet as doing this amazing Christian education work. In fact, when First Baptist expanded in the mid-1920s, Henrietta, again, it was all men that were part of the planning board and that sort of thing, but they asked her to be involved because they needed to find a classroom large enough for her young women, the Fidelis class. And they actually built an auditorium for her class and that would hold 400. But when they maxed out the enrollment at 523 or something like that, they had an overflow room that even overflowed. So, I mean, she was quite the teacher, really based specifically in scripture, really was involved in making sure that her young women were also serving in some capacity. Great sense of humor anyway. Mm-hmm. So as you know, the fundamentalist movement spanned the different denominations in the early 20th century. And in the early 20s, Riley had asked the pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Hollywood, Stuart McLennan, to come fill the pulpit at First Baptist in Minneapolis. And McLennan came, Henrietta and her sister, they lived together at this particular point, invited him over to dinner, and actually he wanted to spend the whole day with them. I mean, he was working on a group of sermons that he was going to present to the Hollywood church, wanted their opinions on where he was headed and that sort of thing. And then of course he heard about the class, the Fidelis class.
Wow.
And it's unclear at this point if he made any overtures to Henrietta Mears about coming to Hollywood.
Sure.
A couple years later, McLennan asked Riley to come. Riley came, filled the pulpit at Hollywood First, and the upshot was that by 1928, Henrietta Mears accepted the position of religious education director, later called Christian education director at Hollywood First Church. So she was there from Hollywood First Press, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
sure. She was there from 1928 to her death in 1963.
Yeah, you see, many people know that time period from our perspective because 1929 obviously is a very big year for us regarding the formation of Westminster Theological Seminary. It turns out not a good year to maybe take a new job or start a seminary.
Right.
And
right.
she doubt would have struggled with those things too.
Yeah, she came about a year before the crash.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, she was really instrumental in developing kind of relief program through Hollywood Church, through the Sunday school that she, of course, was in charge of.
Wow. Now, there's a few threads I'd like to pull on at this point, but it's interesting to hear about these events in her life. And, you know, I was just struck with her confidence and determination. I even struck with her failing eyesight, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. She may be either reading in your book or in supporting materials. She was told at one point in time that she should probably cease her studies, that she needed to quit reading because she was at risk of, you know, going blind. And the, right. Her extensive reading was putting her vision at risk. And she was just determined, well, if I go blind, I go blind. But she wasn't willing to lay aside her studies, most notably her study of the Word of God. And to see her determination and in many ways her faith to seek to serve the Lord in these ways is quite astonishing.
Yeah, she was a pretty amazing woman. She was told that they were afraid she'd lose her eyesight before the age of 20. Mm. Number of folks said you got to quit reading, you got to quit putting the stress on your eyes, and she just the Lord's given me this ability and I need to take advantage of that and do as much as I can for the kingdom. And she did. She was traveling, I think it was in 1957, on one of her trips. She was, I think, she was going to Australia for a visit, and I think she just gotten there and her eye started to bother her. And it turns out she had an ophthalmic rupture in one of her eyes, went right all the way back to L.A., you know, and the doctor said, we don't know if you're going to be able to see. Well, she had to give up driving, but she continued to work for another 6 years almost after that.
Wow. Now, when we hear about her involvement in Sunday schools, we've already eclipsed the 500 mark. When we start talking about First Pres, we're going to start getting over the 6,000 mark to talk about the people that are coming to her class. But, you know, this is just kind of mind-blowing to most of us, especially in the OPC. We don't have a single church with 6,000 people, let alone 500 people. Maybe there's one of our churches that large. Tiny. So the scale is very different. But I'm wondering, you know, what is typical at the time? How exceptional is this even among evangelicals of the time? And more than that, I'm wondering about how do people conceive of Sunday school at this time? It originally started, I'm not getting my dates correct, but early on, it was a way to educate children on Sunday who are working in factories. Now, obviously, we've moved out of that to some extent in late 40s and then on into the 50s, you know, post-war, and it's a different era. And nevertheless, Sunday school is still a big thing. So what's the nature of this education? How did Mears fit into this? And how typical or atypical was her particular Sunday school relative to the rest of evangelicalism?
Yeah, well, if we, again, we've got to, I think our terminology gets a little tricky here. You know, I try to make a distinction between fundamentalism and evangelicalism. And I guess that's helpful. Part of the book is that I'm trying to say Henrietta Mears was a theological fundamentalist, authority of scripture, Trinitarian theology. I mean, she's orthodox in those kinds of ways.
Like the five fundamentals.
But there you go. Exactly. Right. But she was a different, if you compare her, for example, to Riley, and I think in one of the chapters I try to show how she was beholden to Riley, because I mean, she learned scripture under his teaching and in his church. But she really distanced herself from Riley, because Riley was one of those folks that, utilizing kind of modern methods of communication, you know, the media, for example, radio, for example, he really was a person that did not appreciate American secular culture. And so, and again, we see this in so many folks. Again, the fundamentalist issue, or the issue of you know, what is Orthodox Christianity in the modern age, you know, that goes back to the 19th century, you know, post-Darwin and that sort of thing. But by the turn of the 20th century, that had really become a sticky point for many denominations, but particularly the Presbyterians and the Baptists, you know. And so we get this fundamentalist movement where it's not just theologically conservative, but it's also conservative in terms of culture, in terms learning, in terms of any kind of secular pursuits. And so one of the points I try to make in the book is that Mears is a different animal. And that's why the title of the book, The Mother of Modern Evangelicalism, that something is happening in Mears's Sunday school as early as the 20s that most historians don't pick up until the 40s, when you have a bunch of men involved. Harold John Ockenguy and Billy Graham F.H. Henry. Yeah, those folks. But one of the points I try to make is that they're essentially building on what she already did, whether they knew it or not. because she never was a person that shied away from learning. She wanted her students to get the very best education they could. If that meant they went to USC or UCLA or Berkeley or Chicago or Harvard, whatever. I mean, she had students that went to Oxford and Cambridge, Berkeley. I mean, they were at some of the top, Columbia. And she taught them that, you know, faith and informed faith has nothing to fear from learning from secular culture. And so I think that's one of the points I try to make in the book, is that she is a different animal. She's not afraid of learning. She's not afraid of secular culture. Mm-hmm. She believes so strongly in the power of the word to transform people and to give them a sense of who they were as Orthodox believers in the modern world. They didn't have to fear, you know, atheistic professors or whatever. I mean, Riley, her home church pastor, railed against the University of Minnesota. Well, that's, she graduated from the University of Minnesota in chemistry, no less, you know? And she had her own crisis of faith with regard to that, but she came through it. And my sense in reading again the documents is that nothing scared her. She thought, you know, Christ can meet any challenge that the modern culture throws at us. But what we have to do is we have to train our students to know the word. That was the key. And for her, Sunday school was an opportunity for, first of all, for evangelism, second for discipleship, third for service, fourth for contact with the culture in significant kinds of ways.
Yeah, that's really admirable. I appreciate that. It defies in many ways, you know, some of the labels that we might want to put, the simplistic labels. We just had Daryl Hart here teaching a class on Machen a few months ago. And in our conversations, he's talking about lumpers and splitters. And he says he tends to be a splitter regarding the history, looking at the distinctions among groups. With the tendency, especially with the fundamentalist modernist controversy or the Presbyterian conflict, he makes a distinction there too. The tendency is to just lump everyone into one of two groups. Either, you know, you've got Fosdick, you know, and then people not like him. It's just way too simplistic. Yeah. And seeing Mears and her engagement here is really, really fascinating. Jim?
Yeah, that is fascinating stuff. Sounds like she would not have been for the Benedict option then, as you hear that bantered around today. And I agree with that. That kind of puts her more, I guess, what we would call our style, a neo-evangelical label, as opposed to a strictly fundamentalist category, at least fundamentalism or fundamentalist as we understand it, sort of an anti-intellectual withdrawal from culture kind of a mindset.
Or the mother of that movement. That's the thesis here.
My question is just about her teaching style. I mean, were you able to ascertain in your research what exactly it was that drew people to her classrooms? Was it her teaching style? Was it the content, her personality? You did mention her sense of humor. What was it about her that was just so magnetic?
Well, that's a great question, Jim. It's a hard one to answer too, because I think there are a number of things that drew people to her. You know, when she was at the Fidelis class in Minneapolis, that class of young women, she came up with what she called the 10 I wills. So I will win each of my young women to the Lord. I will make sure that they feel comfortable talking to me about anything. So she goes through this list of I wills. And what I think what those 10 kind of hallmarks of her entire ministry tell us is that, number one, she cared very deeply for every person. I mean, her class at Hollywood First Church grew to be over 800. Mm-hmm. And yet she would make sure that she met the people, you know, there's always kind of hangers on or folks that kind of hang back. You know, there are other folks that kind of go to center stage and they're the kind of movers and shakers. But she would talk to those, the movers and shakers. She'd also talk to the folks who, you know, were somewhat shy. Every person I talked to, and I did interviews with over 60 people that knew her very intimately.
Yeah.
Not one of them said they ever felt like she turned her back or didn't care about them. She was able to convince every person, no matter how famous she became, no matter how many celebrities she ran with, political, Hollywood type or other kind of celebrities. She always made time for everyone and anyone who needed to see her. I think her Bible teaching was again Bible teaching. I mean, she taught books of the Bible. She taught topical studies. She wasn't afraid of any topic. I mean, this is a woman in the 40s and 50s who, when they talked about dating and sex education, she would rent films from the LA public school library. To show. She said, the church has to be a place where kids can come and ask any question of their leaders. And that is mind blowing when you think about it in the 40s. And again, of course, those films were very tame compared to what we have now. But the very fact she says that the church has to be the place where we can address all these questions. I mean, it's just phenomenal. So I think she had a sense for the entire person. We call it, whole person learning, right? Which is all the buzz and has been for the last 20 years. She was doing it, 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so to be able to care for each student, to have straight teaching that, again, with humor, sometimes she had some of the, again, to us, the stories sound really kind of maudlin, but to the students back then, I mean, she was personable. She cared for them. She was honest with them. And again, her teaching was right, straight kingdom teaching. And I think people really appreciated that. I'm sure there are other things I could say too, but if you want to ask a follow-up or whatever, Jim, but I think those would be some of the major things. And again, these 10 I wills, they came out when she was in Hollywood, and so much of what she did in Hollywood was prefaced on what she did in Minneapolis and those little towns in Minnesota. And so often people, the earlier books that have been done on her really give you a lot of insight into her Hollywood years, but not very much in the first 37 years of her life. And to me, those years in Minneapolis and North Branch and Beardsley, Minnesota, those are the years when she really perfected these kind of 10 ideas that led her into the tremendous success she had in Hollywood. Mm.
This might be an inside baseball question, but I think it's related. I mean, what type of archives persist? You know, you've traveled all over the place. I enjoyed thumbing through your bibliographic notes, and we had spoken before, as well as some other folks at the Presbyterian Scholars Conference, about some of these details. But I'm wondering what persists in terms of, any writings that she has, correspondence, but also any, are there tapes? Do we have a reel-to-reel? Do we have perhaps any early video? What are we able to access now, or what have you been able to access regarding her archives to get a sense of the woman?
Oh, great question. Yeah, well, the first place I went was the First Baptist of Minneapolis. I wasn't quite sure what was there, but I knew they had a lot of material related to the Mears family, because her mother was so involved in so many aspects of the First Baptist Church. Her father, not so much, but her mother was. So they have a really great archive. Leighton Bruschi, who unfortunately has passed on, was really helpful in helping me access the documents there. A lot of church records, essentially official church records. I have her baptismal record and that sort of stuff. And then the second most significant spot would be the Gospel Light archive.
Yes.
Now, when I was working on the book, Gospel Light was still a thriving venture in Ventura, California, which is, about 80 miles north and west of LA. And that's where her library is, her letters, her diaries. That's the biggest treasure trove of Mears memorabilia and documents. So I spent a lot of time with Gospel Light. Bill Gregg and Anita Griggs are really helpful to me there. And then the Forest Home, the conference center that she started, they have a lot of audio stuff. I do have a few audio tapes of her, some of her speeches that she gave over the years. And those, again, would be Gospel Light as well as Forest Home. Let me think. I think those are the three. There's one other. Well, in the First Presbyterian Church of Hollywood, they have some things. But those are mainly official records, session minutes, and records of her Christian education meetings, or her teachers and staff meetings, and those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. A lot of the social stuff that they did there, and the organization, the Sunday school. But those are the four main repositories. And then, of course, I mentioned some of those different theses and dissertations that are in really helpful too, I think.
Oh, very, very good. Let's talk about Gospel Light a bit, and her involvement. She was a director of education at the church. We can talk a little bit, maybe in a few minutes, about her views on women's ordination. She's very perplexing and really interesting to discuss her views on that sort of thing. But I don't want to jump ahead too soon. I would like to get a sense of her involvement here in Christian publishing. Lots of people that are listening to this right now, whether they know it or not, have probably been influenced by Gospel Light.
Yeah, it was an amazing venture. It started out, everything that Mears did started with the local church, which is, again, I think a really intriguing idea. That she didn't start out to do this international publishing thing that would be used by denominations all over the world,
right,
in multiple languages. She didn't start out trying to develop this huge Christian conference center, which, you know, over 65,000 people a year go to now from all different denominations in all parts of the country. She started out to, how do I build the best Christian education program for my kids? And adults, by the way. She was also part of the adult, she ran adult programs too. How do I do that? And so the Gospel Light story is really an intriguing one. When she first came to Hollywood, Hollywood Church was growing before she came. And it was Sunday school was doing well, its membership was doing well, but they had a lot of turnover in the Christian education side of things. And so when she came, she said, okay, let's just kind of, she met with the Sunday school teachers and says, oh, great. You want another leader to tell you what to do? No, we're not going to do that. So she took, 5 or 6 months, said, let's just cool our jets. You know, let's just kind of go on the way things are. Mm-hmm. We'll make some observations. We'll keep talking with each other and then we'll come up with a plan. So that's the other thing I appreciate about her. She didn't come into Hollywood and said, okay, let's boilerplate what we did in Minneapolis, First Baptist Church, and put it here in Hollywood, California. She didn't do that. She waited to see what was happening in Hollywood. And I think that's really a wise thing to do. Don't come with a pre-printed plan that's going to work somewhere else, it's going to work here.
I know.
I think that was great. Well, anyway, the Gospel Light story, she what happened is that she realized that Christian education materials that were available didn't suit her. There was denominational stuff. There were also other publishing companies, but she was really frustrated with the fact that they seemed to be hit and miss. Now, there's a misconception too that about her that they said she was the first one that developed age graded curriculum in Gospel Light. That's not really true. Mm. There were age graded curricula out there before her, but they weren't for each year, like for, you know, 4-year-olds or 5-year-olds or 7 or 8-year-olds. And that's what she did, closely graded. So every grade is going to be a little different for her. But anyway, what she did is she didn't find, again, anything out there that seemed to work. And so she and some of her colleagues, Esther Ellinghusen, who was, I think she taught junior high school in the LA City School District, Ethel Mae Baldwin, who became her assistant, Stanley Engel became the treasurer. But they got together and they started to say, you know, how can we really develop a curriculum that's going to be Bible-based, that's going to be consistent, and it's going to build on itself. In other words, you know, you're going to repeat, but you're going to always build greater complexity and that kind sort of thing as the kids get older. Mm-hmm. Yeah, from year to year. So Gospel Light started out as essentially they're just printing off materials for their own kids. And that's all they're doing. So the stories are funny. They would get there at 3 or 4 in the morning and run the mimeograph machine, which is how they duplicated stuff back then, and try to get it all stapled together before Sunday school started.
Try not to pass out. Working on, from all the fumes.
It was all in-house. Yeah. It was all in-house stuff. And so essentially they started that way. And then the Sunday school just exploded. I may have my figures wrong here, Ken, and it's in the book, but I think the Sunday school was about 1,624 students when she started there. Once this new curriculum gets, they start churning that out, the Sunday school just explodes. It's up over 4,000 students. And again, this is adults and kids within a few number of years. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, people would come to Hollywood, the other Christian education directors, saying, what's causing this tremendous growth? Because, I mean, it was the talk of the Southland, by the early 1930s. And there was a fellow from Anaheim First Press that said, I'm not going to leave. She said, well, we're just using our own curriculum, you know. And he said, I'm not going to leave here until you give me a copy of that. Yeah. So the story goes that he just would not, he came to visit and he would not leave until she, and that's what started this whole process that led to the founding of Gospel Light, printing initially.
Yeah.
And then ultimately Gospel Light.
But it did arise organically, just out of need, out of serving right. the local church. And then it went from there. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Was Forest Home similar? Did it arise organically? How, you know, I appreciate that we don't seem to have, you know, she's not coming in with an a priori entrepreneurial mindset either. And then maybe like goes to some power brokers who have funds, and then they're coming in with an idea and just establishing institutions. You know, like, she's not like a world builder. Nevertheless, you find her at the middle of these crossroads in many places, and these institutions do arise. But was Forest Home along those lines too?
Yeah, it was. There were a number of conferences. She believed that, you know, Christian education didn't end with the Sunday school hour, that there were other opportunities for that.
Yeah.
And sometimes the best way to get students certainly involved, and certainly in terms of evangelization, was to get them away for a while at a camp or a conference.
Mm-hmm.
So she tried a number of different conference centers in the LA area. I mean, there's this great picture of her riding a donkey to this one conference center. I think the year after she came, you know, she had her.
No one had palm branches, I hope.
no palm branches, just a donkey. And she never did it again, too, by the way. I think it was a little rough ride for her. But in any event, you know, there were Tockwitz Pines was a campground there. Switzer's Inlet. There was a Presbyterian campground. There were Camp Radford was also. So she tried these different camps, but nothing had the facilities that she really thought would be important for her campers.
Mm-hmm.
And so in there was a place called the Forest Home Outing Company, I think is what its original name was. It was actually a resort in the San Bernardino Mountains, about 70 miles east of LA.
Mm.
And it was valued at about a third of $1 million in the mid 1930s.
Wow.
And this is the height of the Depression, of course. It was a very popular spot. When the Depression came, it kind of became a little less prominent because, you know, it cost to do that, and folks just had trouble. But at this place, there would be celebrities from Hollywood that would camp there, as well mm-hmm. as just mom and pop and the kids and that sort of thing. Anyway, the fellow that owned it thought of maybe selling it, because if he died, was he an architect from Pasadena? I can't remember. But anyway, he thought he might sell it, but there was this tremendous storm in the San Bernardino Mountains I think it was 37. I think that was the year, but they had about 30 feet of snow at the top of Mill Creek Canyon. And then they had 3 or 4 days of warm rain, and then it warmed up even more. And so what happened is that this Mill Creek became this raging torrent, almost like a flash flood that swept through the valley and just destroyed much of that area. And of course, it became a real problem in terms of resort. Now, the resort itself only lost a couple, 3 cabins, but it devalued the land because, you know, all the forest was swept away. It was just, by all accounts, it was horrible.
Yeah.
A horrible storm, but it dropped the price.
Yeah,
and so Mears, as well as one of the Hormel folks, the meatpacking family, as well as a couple of other of her folks, got together and said, "Listen, I think we could afford this now." And initially, they were going to have an open house to where members of the Hollywood Church could come and buy a cabin. And then she thought, "Wait a second, that's not going to work, because if I sell the cabins to members of the church, where are my kids going to stay?" You know? So she tossed that idea, and ultimately they bought it for $30,000, 50 some cabins, this entire area, which is just a beautiful campsite. They bought it and turned it into an interdenominational conference center the purchase was finally organized and made in 1938. And from that point on, Forest Home has just been a major conference there. Again, it's not Presbyterian. None of her stuff was ever located just for Reformed folks. I mean, there was always denominational. I mean, she let Gospel Light, she let Amy Semple McPherson's church change some of the pieces of her curriculum to fit their theology. She was not, I mean, she wasn't proprietary in the sense that this is it and you've got to take it this way. She let people adapt her materials in Gospel Light. She invited all kinds of folks to her camp and conference center. I mean, she had psychologists and philosophers and, you know, all kinds of different folks there who were Bible-believing Christians that, again, were demonstrating that you don't have to fear secular culture. You don't have to fear learning. God is bigger than that.
This is, I'm looking at a picture in the book. There's a whole selection of our archival photos that are really, really fun right in the middle of this book. And I'm looking at the one with Billy Graham speaking at Forest Home in the early 1960s. But I did grow up in a mainline Presbyterian church, and this looks like I'm wondering if our fellowship hall was an homage to Forest Home, because I've got like these fond memories of Presbyterianism and Knotty Pine Siding, and they, you know, so probably coincidental. But the picture, no less, you've already mentioned some pretty significant figures, Sister Amy being one. But you know, I'd be curious to know the relationship there and how collegial they were. But thinking of other figures like Billy Graham and Bill Bright, there's some significant evangelical figures that were involved with, or at least crossed paths with, Henrietta Mears. How did some of those come about? Did many of them rise up from within the Sunday school, or are they coming by when they're in their college years? How did they become acquainted with her?
Great question, Cameron. Yeah. Well, Bill Bright would be the example of someone in her college department that, again, rose to prominence out of that church. He actually was born in Oklahoma and started a kind of a candy business in L.A. when he moved there, and became involved in her church. At first, he wasn't all that interested at all. He wanted to make a million, you know, but got interested and became converted. And then he, of course, went on to found Campus Crusade for Christ and other kind of significant developments. So he was within Mears' church. Billy Graham was Riley, William Bell Riley, wanted Billy Graham to take over his Bible college. It's Bethel University now today, but then it was a missionary Bible college, missionary training and Bible college. And he wanted Billy Graham to take that over. In fact, Billy Graham did. He was the youngest college president for a couple of years. He was only in his, mid-30s, I think.
Oh, my.
But I think, and the best I could piece together is that he and Mears met, I think, at Riley's suggestion. And I can't quite, again, it's real kind of iffy, unclear. But I think they met in the mid-40s sometime before Riley passed on. But Mears actually invited Billy Graham. Was not really well known. He was working for a kind of a youth organization and held kind of youth rallies and that sort of thing. But Mears knew of him because of this earlier connection. So she invited him to come to the Forest Home College Briefing Conference, which was a conference that she, again, that's a whole other story, but that, you know, invite collegians from all over the country to come for a week prior to Labor Day weekend. To hear, again, speakers, again, philosophers, Bible teachers, theologians. I mean, they came from all different walks of life. But anyway, she invited Billy Graham to come to Forest Home, and he did. And that course, that's where he had his, this is before, this is 49, this is late August of 49. And of course, September of 49 is when the LA Crusade kicked off. And he was already having doubts about things. His Altoona, Pennsylvania Crusade earlier that year had not gone very well. He was being challenged in terms of the authority of the Bible. And he really probably wanted to back out of the Forest Home conference, but Mears, of course, didn't know what he was going through and said, no, you know, he really would like you to come.
Sure.
So it's at that conference that he actually spends time with Mears at her cabin. She had a cabin at Forest Home called the Biltmore, if you can believe that. and so Billy Graham spent time with her praying and talking through things with her. And that's when he had his great kind of aha moment in terms of the authority of scripture that transformed his life. I've got a hold of this great letter that Billy Graham wrote to her just a few weeks after he got back to, he went back to Minneapolis before the LA Crusade. He wrote this wonderful letter and just says, you know, I have never experienced anything like that before.
Oh, wow.
This is just the beginning of a relationship. I mean, you get that sense from him. And then of course he goes to LA, and bam, there's his there's his introduction to kind of worldwide fame. And again, mm-hmm. what's so intriguing is that Mears people were involved in that crusade. Stuart Hamblin, who is a major, he was probably the most significant radio personality on the West Coast at the time. And he is converted through, at least to some extent, through her influence. He didn't directly bring him to Christ, but people that she knew were very involved, that she discipled, were very involved in his conversion. And so he comes to Christ. Jim Voss, mm. who was a wiretapper for the FBI and the mob in L.A., came to Christ, and he was actually in her college department for a while. Was one of the presidents of the college department. Louis Zamperini, who you may remember the Angelina Jolie movie from a few years ago, based on the book Unconquered. Zamperini became a Sunday school teacher in her class. So you have these really intriguing connections with the 49 Crusade and Billy Graham's involvement there. In fact, he was one of the first speakers at the Hollywood Christian Group because they asked him to come and speak when he was during the Crusade. And he spoke to the Hollywood Christian Group, which Mears also helped found.
Wow. And Jim Rayburn, too, from Young Life, right?
Yeah. And Jim Rayburn. She it's intriguing because here again, you see the importance of her mentorship. Clyde Kennedy was the pastor of a church that Jim Rayburn attended in Texas. And it's through Kennedy that Rayburn got to know about Mears, because he hadn't met her at this particular point. And essentially, Rayburn says, you know, I'll take care of the church kids. You take care of the kids who aren't in the church. So that's where Rayburn began his ministry. That becomes Young Life. And Rayburn said on more than one occasion, everything I learned about youth ministry, I learned from Henrietta Mears. And so, you know, Dawson Trotman, who founded the Navigators, also was involved with Mears. So you see this cavalcade of people, strong evangelical leaders from the mid 20th century that were all kind of in some way connected to her and her multifaceted ministry.
Yeah, we see the thesis of the title bearing itself out here, Mother of Modern Evangelicalism. You know, towards the end, I'd like to pull on the thread comparing, you know, Mears or contrasting Mears maybe to some other figures, most notably the fact that we have this very significant and influential woman, which is notable and important, and we're thankful for that. But yet she maybe would defy certain stereotypes that at least scholars today might have about such a person. You write on page 272, "For a theologically conservative female to exert such power seems to fly in the face of conventional wisdom regarding the role of women in the 20th century church." I wonder if you can tease that out or explain more of what you mean by that, what the expectations would be, why she flies in the face of this, her experience, and you know, maybe we can come back around to it, but I'm also curious how this relates to another figure, you know, Sister Amy Semple McPherson.
That is a...
I know it's a thesis in its own right.
I still struggle with, Camden, because she's that's amazing. She only one time that I find in all her correspondence that she ever said she preached.
Yeah.
She did say it one time, but once she really, her reputation started to grow, she was always a teacher. In fact, that was her kind of nickname. Many of the folks that I interviewed, they would call her teacher or Miss Mears. They never called her Henrietta. And I remember one time I was talking to some of her colleagues and I said, Henrietta. And I realized I felt like I stepped in because I called her by her first name. You know? Anyway, but I think Mears, you know, she lived within that confining place for women at that time. Women can teach other women, kids, but to preach, that was, again, the Presbyterian Church, UPC, I think, first or allows the ordination of women. Was it 58 or something like that, I think. But Mears, she slowly comes around to, I'm not sure she ever really 100% believed that the ordination of women was okay, but she supported women in that. Peggy Cantwell was one of her later well, not later. She probably came along in the 40s and late 40s and early 50s. But Peggy Cantwell eventually becomes ordained in the Presbyterian Church and serves at National Presbyterian in Washington, D.C. And Peggy, I've talked to Peggy, and she said, Henrietta, really did support her. I'm not sure she supported 100% the ordination. Again, that's tough to tease out.
It's opaque.
But she supported women in just about every other thing. I think in the book I mentioned that in the Fidelis class at First Baptist and also in Hollywood, she would actually create offices so women could lead. They were never president of the college department at Hollywood Church, but of course we had presidents in the Fidelis class, but they were all female. See, so she created these offices sometimes. From Rachel Spencer, again, was a great interview. Rachel talked about the fact Henry supported her in all kinds of ways, and these women realized that maybe the ordination issue, again, I can't really tease that. I can't speak categorically if you ever 100% supported that. Yeah. But she supported women in all kinds of leadership positions.
Yeah, and that's encouraging. And also, I'm in the sense of also making opportunities and enabling people to express their gifts and abilities by providing those opportunities. And also demonstrating pretty sound leadership in that regard. It's really remarkable.
Yeah, well, Colleen Townsend was a starlet that actually comes to the college department, becomes a Christian, and leaves Hollywood. It was Luella Parsons, who was a major kind of Hollywood gossip columnist. She wrote a column on that because Colleen Townsend, I mean, so the future was bright for her. She did a few movies for 20th Century Fox and then just left. She married actually the pastor's son and became a very prolific author and speaker on Christian causes. Mm-hmm. But Colleen Townsend was one of them that said, you know, she didn't speak feminism. She just lived it.
Yeah,
and another person who knew her quite well, one of her relatives who headed Gospel Light, William T. Gregg, said, you know, she just lived the paradox. She may not even been completely aware of what she was doing in terms of kind of pushing against some of these boundaries. She just lived it. And I don't know if I can explain it any better than that. It's still a tough call for me after all the research I did to say exactly where she came down on some of these things.
Yeah, and maybe she wouldn't know. I mean, people are complex, and maybe it's different day to day. But you also remark toward the end of the book, just thinking that along these lines, that you inevitably are drawn to think of parallels with our modern day. Mm-hmm. What are some lessons that we might draw or other things we might consider on how teacher mirrors might inform our present circumstances?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the points I try to make there is that she had a big tent philosophy. I mean, she, again, befriended, I mean, I don't have much information on her relationship with Amy Semple McPherson. Mm. Essentially, it was one of the interviews I did with a very close collaborator of hers that said, yeah, they had a cordial relationship, but I couldn't really flesh that out very much. Mm-hmm. But I know Oral Roberts was in her home at least once, other faith healers. She embraced, you know, people across a broad spectrum. Now, certainly in terms of her belief in orthodoxy, there were limits to that. But I mean, she was nominated in the mid-1950s for this major community award that was a national award, actually was awarded in, I don't know if it was each state or each set of states, yeah. But it was a Mary Margaret O'Brien Award. And it was for the woman who made the most positive impact on their community. And it was, it was a collaborative award from the Jewish Women's Organization, Catholic Women's Organization, and Protestant Women's Organization. And she was the nominee for this. So again, to cast a wide net in terms of her ability to connect with secular culture, mm-hmm. and people beyond her own sphere. But she always held to orthodoxy. She was not going to give up, again, the Trinitarian theology, mm-hmm. or the belief in the authority of the Bible. And so I think there's a certain amount of grace there. I think she, some people have taken her to task because she didn't really speak out on issues of race or those sorts of things, or gender. I couldn't find anyone that could ever remember she taught on feminism or anything like that. But I do think that she was able to exhibit a kind of a grace that I think we're sorely in need of. This kind of, you don't have to agree with someone completely, but you need to treat them with respect. Mm-hmm. And I think that Mears did that. She was not afraid to express her own opinion, but she did it in a way, I think, that in nearly every case that I could find that was, again, full of compassion and understanding. And again, I think we could sure use that today.
Yeah. That's I'm pulling on some threads, perhaps a different portion of the spectrum or the scale. But I've been working even recently this morning, was writing an article on Ned Stonehouse and some of this quandary, as Sean Michael Lucas has said, this quandary of ecumenism. But the mm-hmm. question of how not to be an indifferentist, but also not to be a separatist or mm-hmm. unnecessarily exclusionary. It's a challenge, no matter where you find yourself on the theological scale. How to bring together your confessional or theological particulars, the principles that you hold so dear and want to join with and operate in a church under those theological foundations, but yet how to still recognize the Catholicity of the church and the distinctions that we have among the body. You can still say that there are Christians outside of my local church, for example. That's really important that we hold to that, but how we do that can be a challenge, and mirrors might be a help.
I think one, there's a great story about this too, you know, that she was a Baptist. She called herself a Baptarian sometimes, you know, she was a Baptist, obviously, in her growing up years, but she joined the Presbyterian Church. She had no problem with that. But, you know, her Cosmolite stuff was kind of infused with some theology that, you know, kind of dispensational theology. And of course, Presbyterians don't really care for that too much.
Well, it came from Presbyterianism to start with, but yeah, that might be.
But there's this great story about the Presbytery executive of LA Presbytery came to Louis Evans, and who was a pastor of Hollywood in the 40s and 50s. And he said to Louis Evans, he said, you know, you just can't have this Baptist woman heading your Christian education program. And of course, by this time, it was one of the largest Sunday schools in the entire country, you know. Right. And Louis Evans looked at him and said, you know, if you can find a Presbyterian that can do half what she does, I'll hire him on the spot. The executive never said another word to him about that. So yeah. She, and she also, there's another story that, you know, Gospel Light, when it was San Francisco Theological Seminary, of course, trains a lot of Presbyterians out here. And one of the folks I interviewed, Warren McLean, said that when he was at San Francisco, they actually did a survey of Christian education materials, including Gospel Light, and for sort of their connections or disconnections to Presbyterian theology. And McLean said that, you know, when they did that study of Gospel Light, there were some things in there that really didn't square with Presbyterian theology. And so they went back and talked to Mears about that. Within 2 years, she'd revised those parts. She didn't realize that, because again, she was not a theologian. She'd revised those parts of the curriculum so they were not, again, butting up against Presbyterian theological distinctives. And again, they weren't the central doctrines, but they were important to Reformed folks. And so she changed it.
Interesting. Wow. That's fascinating. Well, I mean, we're going to have to do a round two maybe sometime and talk and go dive down. But I desperately want people to get a hold of this book, take a look at it, Mother of Modern Evangelicalism, The Life and Legacy of Henrietta Mears, by our guest today, Arlen Migliazzo. Arlen, this has been so fun. I'm so glad you were able to join us. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
You bet. Thank you, Cannon, for the invitation.
Great
to talk with you.
And you can
thank
follow.
Thank you, Arlen. That
yes.
was great.
Check this out at Erdmans. We'll have a link in the episode description. You can also find information about Whitworth University out in Spokane. And, you know, you can follow up with some baseball history on Rhino if you'd like. But we're online at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our events, our online courses that we have on demand for free, and all of our other programs, a lot of fun stuff. So we most of all want to thank you for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.